I'd like to call our meeting of the Capital Investment Committee to order. We will have the approval of the March 8th minutes. Representative Bennett, have you looked them over? And
I have, Mr. Chairman. I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Today, we are going to have one bill that we'll lay offer for possible inclusion, and we'll have two informational hearings. The first, House File 269, Representative Scott, this is an informational hearing because the bill is not presently in our possession. So once we get it, we can make a motion on it, but we'll hear the presentation today. Representative Scott, welcome to our committee.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair and members. And thank you for hearing House File 269. In my city of Andover, there is a 122-acre waste disposal engineering landfill located in the center of town, which is now a residential area. When it was first built, it was kind of out in the middle of Grow Township at the time. There are now 20,000 people living within a mile of this site. A particular concern is a one-third acre parcel that has a hazardous waste pit that is leaking and contaminating the groundwater and the air above it. The MPCA in 2012 and 13 installed treatment systems to clean up the contaminants. The MPCA, or the state, is spending around $500,000, usually in excess of that, annually to monitor the site and remove the contaminants. Just a little bit of history about this site.
Could you put your board out there?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. In the 1970s, the state took over the WDE, and from 1972 to 1974, they accepted hazardous waste from various governments and from industry. So there are 6,600 barrels of hazardous waste that have been dumped there since the state allowed the dumping. Last year, I was able to get the funding, $650,000, for the planning stages of the removal of this hazardous waste. I'm before you today to ask for the remaining $11.35 million to clean this up. With that, I'll have some closing comments, Mr. Chair, but I would like to turn it over to my testifiers. And this morning, or this afternoon, I have my city administrator, Mr. Jim Dickinson, as my first testifier.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Jim Dickinson, city administrator, city of Andover, within Representative Scott's district. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. And again, this bill, the real details of what's there and what they want to do, I'm going to leave that for the MPCA to discuss. They are subsequent testifiers to myself. But to kind of give you a broad brush approach on this, the city is extremely supportive of this project. It's not one where you see the MPCA and the city at odds as to whether or not something should be done at this potential location. The city has worked with the MPCA. We have a good working relationship with them, and we strongly encourage them to continue to move forward on this bill. The state has ultimately accepted the responsibility for this landfill. That took place back in 1995. And with that, the city's of the opinion at this point, with the state taking that responsibility, it's the state's responsibility to clean it up. The city has worked with the MPCA over the years. We've adopted the ordinances that have been requested by the MPCA, which has put in place prohibitions of structures within a certain distance of the landfill. There are to be no structures within the perimeter of the landfill at 200 feet, and then we're to put in place special conditions for anything within 500 feet. I did hand out some maps for the site, and you will notice that if you see the one that has the big WDE in the middle of it, you'll notice that there's some pretty intense development that actually is surrounding that. If you look to the south, which has the 200 and the 500-foot barrier, in the lower right area, you'll see one building that is an industrial building. We actually worked with them very closely So within that 200 and 500-foot barrier, they did put in an active venting system, which was required as part of the process. The city and that individual that built that building worked very closely together to make sure that we could have a good quality structure. What was interesting is we originally start with a 20,000-square-foot building and end up being over 50,000. So, again, it was kind of a home run, particularly in an area that was kind of untouchable for quite a while. But they saw the value from a long-term perspective. But looking forward, you know, we're concerned about public safety within the community. Just to the north of that landfill is the Coon Creek, a natural water body. That water body does ultimately flow to the Mississippi River, so please keep that in mind. The groundwater has some contamination, and the PCA has acknowledged that. You see that in their report. That is of concern. We have residents that have private wells that are within a half a mile and 1 mile of this site. Granted, they at this point in time, they could be within one different flow area of how that groundwater moves, but that is of significant concern. Also, as you look at the one map, I've identified all the public school buildings that are within 1 mile of this site. There are over 5,000 students that are at those schools on any given day. So with that, I kind of conclude my presentation. I would leave the details to the PCA to cover all the finer aspects of that, but I certainly urge you to support funding this removal of the hazardous waste pit. And actually, I look at that as step one. We would like to see much more things happen with the landfill, but this has to be taken care of first. So.
Well, thank you. One quick question. What is the population of Andover?
Just shy of 33,000.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Scott, do you have other testifiers you wish to bring up?
I do, Mr. Chair. And I will let the MPC come up and go through their – they have a brief slide presentation.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I think to start off, I just want to talk a little bit about the closed landfill program. It was referenced a couple times, and just an understanding of what it is. Many folks are more familiar with Superfund. Superfund was created at a time where we had a number of contaminated properties across the United States. Love Canal is the one that most folks know about. And in those cases, we usually have one, two, maybe three responsible parties. And under state and federal Superfund law, those folks are required to do the cleanup, and it puts in a process so that cleanup is done, and then determining between those parties who covers the cost, that's all done afterwards. So we get, first and foremost, the environment and human health is protected. In the case of landfills, we have hundreds of responsible parties. And this played out in the early 90s in Minnesota at Oak Grove Landfill, which is in the northern suburbs also, where we had the system bogged down, where you start having 100 parties trying to determine what is the cleanup action, who's responsible, who's going to do the work, who's going to pay for it. It just ended up into large legal and administrative fights. Time and money was being wasted, and there was no cleanup being done. And so what the legislature did in 1994 created the closed landfill program. It was based on the assumption, and it's the only one in the nation, that landfills everyone contributed to. They are the responsible parties are society as a whole. So the state would take over the duties for cleaning up the landfill. In return, those potential responsible parties needed to cooperate in a few different ways. One, the landfill owner had to turn the site over to the state to be able to do the work. Whether they turned over the actual deed or they kept it under their ownership, that was up to them. And the other responsible parties had to turn over their insurance and also the financial assurance dollars to help with the cleanup. And the state would use that money, along with the solid waste tax and also bonding dollars, to properly care for these facilities into the future. And in doing so, we avoid all those other costs and delays and actually get to the root of the problem. And what we wanted was to prevent degradation of the environment and make sure we protect human health. And so that's the story also with WDE. It had started as a federal Superfund site. First, it was a landfill, as mentioned, permitted by the agency. In 72 and 74, the only landfill in the state that was ever permitted to accept hazardous waste, and that was just for 14 months until at that point we determined that things were not going as the state had wanted, and we shut down the site for various issues. However, I continue to accept other mixed municipal waste, the trash here, all common with that we throw away in our garbage cans until 1983. This time is also when the site became a federal Superfund site, and there were starting discussions of who had to do what and who was paying those costs. And we'll talk about four different treatment systems that have been installed. And in 92, the first one is groundwater. As mentioned by both the representative and the city, is that there is contamination in the groundwater that goes to a number of places, including the creek to the north. In addition, a trench and slurry wall construction was built around where the hazardous waste was being stored. And we'll talk about that a little bit. The idea was we had a bottom that we hoped would be protective and then tried to wall it off on the sides. Those actions were taken, and then before it entered the program under federal Superfund, and then the state came in and did additional things such as landfill gas extraction system and also working on other types of systems in 1998. In 2012 and 13 to deal with PCBs that were being found in the groundwater that we were sampling and also dealing with the vapors. This site, because of the hazardous waste in 1986, the risk was looked at. The concern was the amount of vapors. Even when we were starting to investigate, it became clear it was too dangerous even for the workers to be in the area for us to be able to take care of the problem as we would like. So what these four systems have been doing is they've been addressing the symptoms of the problem and not allowing us to get to our remedy that we would like, which is taking out those 6,600 drums of hazardous waste and properly dispose of them. So what we've done is basically created these four systems to, at a very high cost to the state, to block the systems and also start taking vapors out of the area so that it could be safe to work on. And now our cost for that has historically been up to $600,000, around the $500,000 to $600,000 a year for operation costs, and that is for those four systems, the PCB removal, vapor extraction, landfill gases, methane at the landfill, and then also the groundwater pumping. The picture you see here, I talked about those walls. The black material are those walls disintegrating and coming back through our systems that are capturing the hazardous waste in that. And this is our concern of the long term. Not only the containment systems built in the landfill are failing, but our systems are now being clogged up by those systems, by those materials as they're starting to work this way through our vapor systems or our groundwater collections. So as mentioned before, the risk is to the groundwater and to the population around the location. Our solution is to do an extraction of those barrels and then refill up the hole. Thanks to the representative, we were able to get dollars to start with the design work. We've been able to do additional investigation of documents and started this week doing drilling to pinpoint the exact location of the materials. And the dollars will also allow for us to do a final design for the project. The end date of this is we will have that final design ready for June, so that with a new fiscal year, we will be ready to actually implement the cleanup, which is digging up those barrels, moving them to a new location, and patching back up the landfill. And that's where the additional request for $1.35 million is the pre-design estimate that we have.
Sold.
So what does that $11.35 million do? That, as I mentioned, removes the hazardous materials. It will allow us to repatch up, take waste from other spots, put it into the area where the material was, and cap it. We would need to make sure that cap has its integrity all the way across. Our goal with the closed landfill program is to dry out the landfills to prevent them from creating things that get into the groundwater. And that first line of protection is that liner on top, preventing rainwater from getting into the waste that's there. Just a quick history here. This is the landfill. At the start of the landfill, as you can see, the community had not developed around it, and so why the landfill was located where it was. And today's picture showing the community has grown around it and the potential risk to homes and businesses along with the recreational areas. For that, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, Representative Carls.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kadelka, looking at the handout, I'm not sure if that came from PCA, but the handout with the pictures and so on page 4, it says the hazardous waste pit is leaking into the groundwater, and I'm interested in how far that leaking and contaminated water has moved. And the reason I ask that, we had a hazardous waste site when I represented part of Brooklyn Center a number of years ago, and it was leaking into lake, Twin Lake, which was actually a fair distance away, but the testing showed that that contaminated water had moved some distance. And so I would be interested when I see the picture that you've got up there right now and how close that housing is to the pit, and then as the city manager pointed out, there are some schools that aren't too far away. So how far has that contaminated water moved from the pit site? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we can get you a map of the plume information. It has reached to the creek to the north. That's what started the need for the treatment system that's built around the landfill. And the goal is to capture as it leaves the property right now before it moves any further. The good news is the city itself is on municipal drinking water, which is something that's tested regularly by the Department of Health, and there's not that risk to those folks at this time. The concern would be if this were to, we are no longer able to contain it, and it were able to move to the drinking water wells that the city's map shows further to the north. I don't have with me the exact testing numbers for that. We'd have to get back to you on those.
But it has moved. The reason Mr. Chairman, asked the question was the reference that there were wells and so on in the area, and I assume that you were referring to individual homeowners having wells. And there are some, somebody said. Okay.
Yeah, actually, I can point out on the map. We were looking at map on your site. There are some private wells.
Sir, could you sit down so you're talking to the mic and maybe have someone else hold it for you? Or?
The areas circled there are the ones that still are neighborhoods that have private wells.
Dana, would you point it out to us, or Representative Scott?
And those would be within 1 mile of the site. The ones further over to the west, which would be where Round Lake Boulevard's at, those would be outside of 1 mile.
Okay. So for today, apparently that hazardous waste is contaminated water for some distance. The creek was mentioned. Apparently hasn't gone across the creek. Apparently it's the creek itself that's being contaminated from what it sounded like. The other question I had would be of Mr. Kadelka. You indicated that the waste would be moved to a new location, and if you could explain what that means when you say to a new location, or just so we're not moving a given problem just to another location, it continues to be a problem.
Mr. Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, it would be moved to proper ways to dispose of hazardous waste. And the two big ones is, one is incineration and other types of landfills that are specially designed to handle these types of hazardous chemicals. And those are usually done outside the state. That's where a lot of these chemicals, even today when they're created, they travel and are transported outside the state.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that represents, in other words, that's probably yet to be determined where you're going to move it to, but it would be a safe site and or it would be burned. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Kudelka, I think. So help me understand this, the funding of this bill in the context of the history you described and then this other legislation moving forward, which I think is in the environment bill for the other landfill in Representative Ross Peterson's district, I think. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that closed landfill cleanup fund was supposed to be planning ahead for things like this, and that it was intended to deal with all the 109 landfills around the state. But in the environment bill, do we use all that money up for that one landfill? And doesn't this bill show the problem with doing that, using an entire fund for one problem, which means a problem like this can't fall back on the fund?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the fund that's being referred to is the Closed Landfill Investment Fund, affectionately known as CLIF. It is where a number of the 50% of the insurance recovery dollars went into to help with the long-term care of landfills. And that fund is not allowed to be used by the agency until after fiscal year 2020. And the goal there would be to use that for the long-term operation cost of systems. Historically, getting a landfill in the shape it needs to be able to take care of it long-term, those projects have been done in bonding dollars, especially when we start looking at projects that are several million dollars. For instance, Washington County and other landfills, the legislature has appropriated bonding dollars to help those. In the case of Freeway Landfill that you're referring to in the city of Burnsville, it would be the intent of the agency, if it were to come into the program. I talked about earlier that agreement, the cooperation agreement, the landfill has not entered the program, which is the cause of the problem right now. The agency would seek bonding dollars for that also, because it would do just as you said, drain the closed landfill investment fund, so there wouldn't be dollars to take care of these sites long-term in perpetuity, because the state has signed an agreement that we are going to be taking care of these landfills into the future.
And so, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up one. I was somehow thinking, though, that in that environment bill, they do, in fact, drain the fund. Am I misunderstanding that?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, they do, and we do oppose that effort.
Oh, you do oppose.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing this forward. Just a couple questions, whose barrels are they? Who brought in the contaminants? Are they going to be helping in terms of the cleanup? What is the contaminant? And then second question is the housing developments that took place after the landfill was closed, and the developers, did they have to let people know what was in the landfill when they developed that area?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take the first question you had is, do we know who are the folks that brought materials there? And the answer is yes. And part of the closed landfill agreement, what we do is when they turn over the landfill owner to the state, and the turn over the insurance recovery, their insurance and financial assurance, the deal is the state would move forward and not go after them for the cleanup costs. So as part of the agreement, the state and the made under the legislation, the state cannot go to those parties to seek those dollars once they've entered the program. And that's a difference on Freeway, and I know there's three different landfills being talked about this session, so that's one distinction. In terms of what is there, a lot of it is volatile organic compounds. One of them is TCE. It's an old degreaser. A lot of industrial processes used to do that. PERC, which is often used in dry cleaning, but also can be used as a cleaning chemical, and vinyl chloride, which is a breakdown of those. And those are the type of chemicals that we're dealing with. I think that was the first set of questions. The second set was notification of the folks to the north. And so, in general, specifically to these, I don't know the answer. In general, whether or not someone is notified of that has really changed over time. When these houses may have first been being located there, there may not have been understanding of what the potential risk is. When there's a Superfund site and the people are hooked up to their drinking water municipal system, where the Department of Health and MTCA really focus on is testing the water that's being provided to the whole community to make sure that there isn't a problem. In cases where there's private wells, as mentioned, we will go to landowners to make sure that they're aware of and do testing. Around this facility, we have monitoring wells, and the city is also doing sampling as part of their regular work with the Department of Health to ensure that there isn't drinking water issues. So they're taking part in that way. If someone needs to take specific action, we do try to get that information to them, and we've been working with the Minnesota Realtors during housing sales right now. So if you have a drinking water system that has something that needs to continue to operate and you're the new owner, the seller needs to let you know so you at least know how to operate it to make sure you're protecting your family. So it's a transition, and we're moving that way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, was it 94 when the state took sort of ownership or possession of it, or was it before then? And the reason that I ask that, when I look at these houses that are to the west, you know, they seem like they're within 150, 200 feet. I'm just wondering what the process, they're not within 100 feet? Oh, they look really close. And I'm curious, you know, what was the process by which a developer was able to get the approval to do these tracts that are close to the landfill? And I'd really like to know the dates specifically.
Any time a development comes through Andover, there's they have to go through a public hearing process when they plat the land out. As part of that process, their site locations, anything that's a neighboring to a potential development is identified. The developers would definitely know that it's there. In all due respects, the size of the landfill within the city of Andover is really kind of tough to miss, about 110 acres, and as you look at it, it looks like a small mountain within town. So from that standpoint, the developers are very cognizant of what was there. As you look at most of that development to the, as I would say, to the southwest, that would probably be 1990 development. As you look at development just to the north on the Coon Creek, there's a cul-de-sac that comes down from the north. That was done in early 2000s, but there was a significant identification of what was in the area. And then as you look to the east of the landfill site, where you're seeing some of the higher density off, which would be east of Hanson Boulevard, again, that would have been development done during the later 80s, early 90s, and then some of it a little bit further west, getting into the 2000s. But we would have complied and adopted the provision of no structures within the footprint of the landfill site, the 200 of no build, and 500, which would be you'd have to have active venting systems in any location for that.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up. The house is just directly to the west. You're telling me that those houses are more than 500, or do they have active venting?
They would,
Mr. Dickinson.
Those would be within 200 feet of the footprint. I would believe, as I'm looking at those, they would have to have been outside of the 500 to be constructed from the footprint of the landfill.
Okay, I'm still not understanding the proximity.
I'm in.
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I was just talking to my colleague, the lead engineer. There is a gas probe in between the landfill and the homes to be able to monitor if there is any concerns with gas migration at this time.
Thank you. Representative Dean, are you done?
For now, yes.
Thank you. Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sort of is getting to where I was going to go. Is there any active water well testing going on relative, particularly to these, I mean, one of these sites, these circle generalizations, kind of the one to the southwest, looks fairly close when you start dealing with the movement of water plumes, the subsurface sources of water. So can you help me understand a bit what's the risk monitoring and which direction is the plume moving, those kinds of just orientation information?
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to take a high level real quick and then turn it over to Peter Tiffany, our lead engineer on the project. In general, we have monitoring systems around all of our closed landfills. to ensure that we are keeping tabs on if there is any movement on it. In terms of the homes and drinking water, as mentioned, most of these are through the municipal drinking water system, and the Department of Health does regular testing for that with the city and oversight of that to make sure that we're keeping tracks on that. More specifics of well locations and plume direction, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Tiffany, if that's okay.
You're welcome. Identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Peter Tiffany. I'm a principal engineer in the closed landfill program. I've been in the closed landfill program for 22 years and have always been assigned to this site. We have, I would guess, in the neighborhood for monitoring wells, somewhere around 30 monitoring wells around the site, possibly even more. The hydrogeologist would have an accurate number of that. We do have 8 pump-out wells that 7 of them are along the northern and pretty much the northern boundary, and then there's one within the hazardous waste pit itself. Depending upon the quality of that water that we're pumping out, depending upon what the contamination is, it either gets sent to the treatment pond, which is a lined pond, 2 aerators in it, and then that overflows into the sanitary sewer system, or else the water can be discharged, if it's clean enough, back into a sedimentation basin, which is just on the north side of that treatment pond, and it seeps back into the groundwater. But at that point, it's clean enough water that we don't have an issue with that. I report to the city of Andover quarterly how much water we have discharged into the sanitary sewer system, and it's usually over 2 million gallons a quarter. We pay the city over $8,000 a quarter, as I recall. One more dollar amount, I guess, to bring in. I was speaking with our hydrogeologist just yesterday about some of the costs, and she tells me that we spend roughly about $40,000 a year on sampling and analysis of the monitoring well system around there.
Just one small follow-up then. So that was exactly what I was looking for. What about the personal wells that somebody may be using, or are there no personal wells in the general relationship to this site?
Mr. Tiffany?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are 2 houses on the north side of Coon Creek that have private drinking water wells. I believe they are both screened in the deeper aquifer. There's kind of 2 layers of groundwater here, and what we're concerned about in terms of discharge of contaminants into Coon Creek is from an upper aquifer. The deeper aquifer has so far remained clean, but we are very concerned about that because that deeper aquifer could be a lot larger problem for other wells.
Okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions for Mr. Dickinson. Hey, Jim, nice to see you. I'm very familiar with this site, everyone. Andover's not that far from Champlin, and I've driven by this site hundreds of times probably, and like Mr. Dickinson says, it's like a little mountain in the middle of town, so it's hard to miss. I have a couple of questions. Number one, Mr. Dickinson, from a zoning perspective, and I think that was touched on a little bit, but as the city grew up around this, the city of Andover was pretty cognizant of the zoning restrictions and the development that you did. Maybe you could sketch that out a little bit for us.
Mr. Dickinson.
Relative to the zoning in this area, for instance, those that are familiar with zoning, this landfill has its own special zoning district, which basically says nothing will happen on this site. And we kind of plan around that nothing is going to happen on this site unless something real huge would happen to take place if the entire landfill was removed. But with that, anytime any kind of indication within the boundaries of this landfill takes place within our zoning code, when we've talked about the ordinances that we have put into place, when you're in close proximity to this, we then bring that ordinance in place. and then we do special notification within those areas. We also notify the PCA, who gets the opportunity to review any kind of platting activity that may take place within this area. So in addition to the city oversight, where it would go through the process, the community notification process, we also then notify the NPCA, which is not normally standard.
Representative Bloom. Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, Andover High School is in proximity to this. What are your concerns about that?
Mr. Dickinson.
It's the close proximity to the Coon Creek. A lot of science classes actually utilize the Coon Creek for biology class, et cetera. The school actually owns property down to the creek, so we have a number of students that may utilize that or actually wade within the creek for some of their programs that they may have. And the water does flow both north and south, so it goes right past the school.
Okay. Thank you. I'd just like Mr.
Representative Bloom.
I'd just like to conclude a little bit. As I think the committee can see, right now there's a significant cost both to the PCA and to the city with what we're continuing to do year after year after year on this project. And so there is a payback. There's a payback to the ask here for cleaning this up. It's been kind of a thorn in the side of the North Metro for many years, and I think Commissioner Kadelka could testify to that. So it would be great if we could do something. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to take one more question from Representative Hansen, but if,
no, that's fine.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Kadelka, and I apologize if you answered this already. I had another bill up in another committee. I see here the landfill entered into the closed landfill program in 1995. Is that correct?
Representative Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Kadelka, what would have happened if the landfill had not gone into the closed landfill program? What's the alternative? The closed landfill program.
Mr. Kadelka, I didn't mean to demean you by calling you representative earlier, so you may answer now.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this site was in the federal Superfund program where it was the responsible parties were coming together to try to find a solution. They had to cover the cost. They had to do the work. And so it is a much more labor-intensive legally, administratively, and drives up costs and delaying times. That's the reason the legislature created a closed landfill program in 1994.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Commissioner Kadelka, how many landfill sites have entered into the closed landfill program?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there are 113 currently eligible. There are 109 in it, and we have one of them that are fairly recently been made eligible and working its way to it, and another one that there's legislation moving this session to become eligible in Crow Wing County.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Commissioner Kadelka, what would be the total cost for the unfunded obligations for the closed landfill program?
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Kadelka.
We have a 30-year estimate. I have it at my chair, unfortunately, but it is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The closed landfill program to date has spent just shy of $400 million for the 109 sites, and we have long-term needs for keeping these systems operating and replacing them when they break down.
Representative Carlson, did you have a quick question, then we'll move on to Representative Tice?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I thought you maybe were keeping a list. I wasn't trying to bump anybody.
I would just like to do one more, and that would be you, and then we'll move on.
Oh, okay. My question is that the request here is for $11,350,000, and during the testimony, there was reference that the parties that had contaminated the fund had, as a part of their contractor agreement, turned over their insurance information. And so my question is, what is the total cost of cleaning up the landfill, assuming that the insurance that these entities have had is covering part of the cost? And then a follow-up to that is there agreement that those insurance companies will be making the payment? In other words, are any of them protesting it? So what is the net is the basic question.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the settlements with the insurance companies were global settlements for all the properties at one time, and those were already done and have concluded. The state collected $96 million as a result of those settlements. It's the only type of settlement in this type across the nation. Minnesota was a leader in this, and so it was not an easy request of the insurance companies to turn over those dollars. Those dollars have been being used for construction, and also some of them were the seed money for the closed landfill investment fund. So at this point, there's not dollars to offset these costs. The $11.35 million would be the full request and bonding dollars. To the earlier question of the obligation, we do a memo every year to MMB, and the next financial obligations for the state for the next 30 years is estimated at $202 million as a result of the $109 that we have in the program today, knowing that there are additional ones to enter the program.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I was assuming that insurance, those insurance payments were related to this specific site, but apparently it was part of a global coverage, the 90-some million, so thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Scott, do you have any concluding comments?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of the closed landfills that were mentioned here, the 109, there's only one with the hazardous waste pit, and that's in Andover. That's this project. And this is the MPCA's top priority. I just wanted to say, you know, in state government we fund a lot of things that many would question whether they're really a function of state government or not, and whether it's a responsibility of state government. And I think this is the cleanup of this state-owned site, in my mind, leaves no question that this is the function of government to assure the risks to human health and the environment. And so I would just ask for the committee's support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Scott. And once the committee comes in possession of the bill, we'll give it due consideration.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 423, Representative Tice. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative Tice.
Thank you. And yes, I did change clothes. Several folks have said, "Did you change clothes?" And it's like, yes, I did.
I thought it was Representative Lucero.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy to be here today to let you know what a wonderful opportunity we have in this bill to add some looping wiring to some of our structures when we do construction projects or retrofits or whatever we're doing, to help people who are hard of hearing. And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I would like to do a brief oral amendment to change in the title, hearing impaired with hard of hearing.
We will take into consideration your oral amendment. I'll move it. Would you repeat it again, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.3, we would like to replace hearing impaired with hard of hearing.
Okay, I will move that. Any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Continue.
Thank you. We were just getting some feedback that hard of hearing was a better term to use, so we wanted to change that quick. Having a husband who wears hearing aids and has for quite a few years, it's really difficult for him in certain settings to hear what's going on. And it has to do with all the noise that's happening. And so when I heard about what looping does and how it can help folks with hearing in bigger auditoriums, even like our chambers, it's really hard to hear sometimes. And a lot of folks will wear their headphones so that they can hear better. But if we continued or we started doing the looping software, they wouldn't be needed anymore. There would be a really easy fix with hearing aids because they have so much technology in it. But I'm not going to go much further. I'm just going to turn it over to somebody who knows much more about it than I do.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Identify yourself, please. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is John Woodley, and I am
has asked to testify today because I have had hearing loss, pretty severe hearing loss all my life, and have had direct experience, I guess, with the legislature and in the past, and so can maybe explain to you how helpful a hearing loop could be. I wore hearing aids for many years in both ears, but before I was able to afford hearing aids, you know, are very expensive, I spent some parts of my career involved in government, and one of the most difficult things I had throughout that time without hearing aids was the ability to go to a legislative hearing and follow what was going on in the room. Very difficult, very stressful, intimidating. You feel insecure when you are among other people who are interested in the policy, and you feel you might be at a disadvantage because you're not hearing everyone. Little things like in a committee room today, if one of the members is sitting in the inside and leaning this way and not speaking directly into their mic, I can't hear them. There's no intention on the part of the members to make it so somebody can't hear, but it's just sort of the way that it plays out. Everybody's voice is a little bit different, and for people with hearing loss, it is the ability to hear at various tone levels that sometimes is difficult. Later in life, I was diagnosed with atherosclerosis, and I finally found out just exactly what was wrong with my hearing. I was able to have surgery and restore my hearing at the University of Minnesota, a miracle process. And so for the past about 10 years, I have not worn hearing aids, and I can hear much better. However, soon, I am going to be 70 years old this year, and I'm going to be back to wearing hearing aids just through the normal process of hearing loss, age-related. And it is at that age, at 70, where, as I look around the room, many of you are, I can tell, not even close to 70. But when you get there, you may experience the same thing with hearing loss. And I can tell you how terribly frustrating it can be and is, and how it can lead to other issues in your life, depression especially. And that a simple little wire that would go around this room and connect with a hearing aid through a system called a T-coil would allow people with hearing loss to observe what you are saying, follow the policy discussions without frustration. It is inexpensive. It is comprehensive. It is a miracle. And for the aging population, and I don't have to tell you about how many of us are now, baby boomers, are now becoming part of that 70 and over crowd, it will make immense difference if this was something that public meeting places such as rooms like this, rooms at schools, public buildings in small towns with aging rural populations would accommodate. That's my story, and thank you for hearing it.
Thank you. And I don't think there's been a fiscal note done on this yet. Do you have any idea, let's just say this room, what it would cost to do what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, Beth Fraser with the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. There has been a fiscal note done on this bill, and it came back at zero. That's because this bill requires that during the planning process for projects that include public gathering spaces, that hearing loops and good acoustics be considered and that those requirements can be waived if they cost too much. It also exempts any projects that are past the planning stage to be sure it does not add unexpected costs to any projects that are already kind of in the pipeline.
So, Mr. This is for new construction?
So it's for new construction or remodels, major remodels. In the Senate building, hearing loops were installed in the hearing rooms, and they were about $16,000 a piece, I believe, which, given the price of overall construction, is relatively minor. And in that room and most rooms, they are required to provide an assistive listening system for people with hearing loss. So it's just a question of which assisted listening system. Hearing loops are preferred by those with hearing loss because, as Mr. Woodley was explaining, they can connect wirelessly to your hearing aid if you have one with a T-coil. And so you can get the sound directly to your hearing aid. It's better than using earphones because if you have a hearing aid, you can't put the earphones in without removing your earphone or without removing your hearing aid, which means that you then lose the correction that the hearing aid provides. Hearing aids don't just amplify sound. They actually correct it. So you can't just use headphones. It also just projects the sound into the microphone. It doesn't just make everything louder. So it is, as I understand it, very crisp, very intelligible sound when a hearing loop is provided.
Mr. Woodley.
Mr. Chairman, I neglected when I introduced myself to explain that I am a member of the Commission on Deaf and Hard Hearing and Blind Deaf for the state of Minnesota. And so that's why I'm involved in this. And I would also like to mention that I am co-chair of a task force through that committee that is, along with former Representative Huntley, we are co-chairs. And we are looking at the problem of age-related hearing loss. And this is one of the issues that we're taking up as a result of that task force.
And for those who may not know it, Mr. Woodley was also member of the staff of a previous governor in the state of Minnesota.
That's correct. I was on the staff of Governor Ventura, but I should mention that I never had any trouble hearing him.
I was just going to say, I was going to ask you if you ever said, "Boy, I'm glad I didn't hear that."
I said a lot of things during that time. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Representative Boogman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions for the author. Representative Tice, nice to see you. Been at least 15 or 20 minutes. How did you come to the number of 15 for these gatherings?
Representative Tice?
Actually, that would probably, thank you, Mr. Chair, that would be a better question for Beth. But I think, really, I think anytime you get a group bigger than that, around that and more, there's always a lot of noise. There's always a lot of chatter from somebody. And it just really gets hard to hear. Just being with Greg, my husband, and it really depends on what kind of a room it is, if he can hear. If there's, you know, it's a relatively quiet room, the acoustics are good, which, you know, we've heard before that part of this is making sure we have good acoustics. But also, if it's a bigger room and it's only 15 people, he can't hear well. And sometimes for us, you know, just going to church is a big deal. You know, it's hard for him to hear. And a lot of times, I don't hear much of what's going on because he's constantly asking me, what they say, you know, so we're doing that. But I'll have Ms. Fraser probably answer that a little bit better than me.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser again. The I do want to explain that the bill does have two pieces, and one piece is about the hearing loops, which is what we've been focused on. The other piece is that it does require looking at good acoustics and looking at ways to plan the construction so that the acoustics in the room will be ideal. The acoustical standards were originally put in place for classrooms, so because obviously students need to be able to hear in a classroom in order to be able to learn, and were originally voluntary for classrooms. And the School Board Association, after several years, came back and asked the legislature to make the acoustical requirements or the acoustical standards mandatory. And we were excited, but questioning, like, well, you want these to be mandatory. You know, usually people do not come to the legislature and say, please impose this upon us. And they said, actually, what we found is that when we do not follow the acoustical standards, we have to do costly retrofits to make it so the students can hear. And so it's cheaper and easier for us up front to use the acoustical standards. The number of 15 is just, it's a number that was chosen because of factors that Representative Tice was talking about, just that with larger groups it becomes harder to hear.
Representative Uglum?
To the testifiers then, so would you envision then if we're doing a renovation here at the state in one of the many conference rooms, then we would have to do this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, yes.
Okay.
That would be the expectation.
Mr. Chair. Representative Uglum.
And then as far as renovation, you're not defining renovation in the bill. What do you consider renovation?
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the bill does specify that the renovation has to be of that space, so it's not just of the building itself. It's not that if you're renovating the bathroom that you then need to change the conference rooms.
Representative Glenn.
Well, what I'm driving at is if we're doing a remodeling, new carpet, paint, or whatever, many people would consider that renovation, and that's not defined here in the bill to that extent. So I'm just concerned that we might be doing a lot of spaces and considering that. So
I think Mr. Woodley has an answer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Woodley.
Mr. Chair, members, I currently work in the construction business, and generally in the business, renovation refers to structural change. It's not the redecorating. However, I certainly understand that a definition might be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking around, and I don't know if I see any of my colleagues that actually have hearing aids. I was in this building at the beginning in December. I've had hearing aids now for about 3 years, and I'm actually at that magic age. I'm 68, and so it happened a while ago. My background, I was a band director, and if anybody has ever been a band director, been in front of pep bands, you know that what you are doing is you will have hearing aids. But anyway, what happens is, as far as this bill goes, I can tell you that the difference between having this system, which in this environment I had the sound people all and we did some experiments, and as long as you, I'm sorry to say it this way, but as long as you actually get the microphone in front of you, I can hear you. If you don't, if, for instance, you think that's good enough, I don't hear you at all. Not at all. And so it'd be similar to if he were testifying and only looked away from his microphone. Now, as far as somebody like myself, having this system, it's a function of our amplification system. That's how you want to think of it. It's as important as having speakers. Because those speakers that we see are actually that wire for those of us that wear aids. So it is extraordinarily important. It's just that generally because you're a hearing person, without needing the assistance of devices, you just don't think it's that important. But it is as easy as that. It's like turning the volume off as you walk from one place to the other. These rooms are also very interesting. I can almost guarantee that at this proscenium right here, sound stops. Unless the microphone is really working well and you're really in the microphone when you're talking, I can sit back there and not hear a word. Unless somebody has their big boy speaking voice on. You know, that speak like an adult when we tell our kids. I'm only sharing this so that you understand that this is not a little issue. For some people, whether I was 25 or 55, and for the gentleman, as he was living all of his life until he got it repaired, he lived in that world all the time, walking in and out of sound. And it's very frustrating for those of us that have this. I would only share that if you think this is a little bit important, multiply it by 10. That's its value to those of us that are impacted. So I want to share that so you really understand this is important. And he said that you sometimes walk around, you feel diminished, you feel less, and you feel unimportant. And I've had about 8 weeks of that. But now, some would say that that's because I'm in the minority. But I think it's been unintentional, but it is systemic. And I can tell you, I have carried along my earbuds so that when I'm over on the floor, if somebody gets up and is, you know, orating but isn't in the microphone, I plug in, and it is like they crawl inside my head instead of talking. It really makes a difference in the life of the person who's affected. So I am completely for this, if you haven't been able to figure that out. And I will tell you that it isn't like a major deal to get it installed, because to a large extent, what's in that wall right now can drive the loop. It takes just a little transducer, and they hitch the wire up and plug it into the speaker, and this room would be live. So it isn't a gigantic deal, as you were concerned about cost, which is relevant and very important. But it can be very effective. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Salk may be closer to somebody that doesn't realize that wears hearing aids. You just happen to have misplaced them. And I'm not close to 70 anymore. But there seems to be something about the age, late 60s or 70s. That's when I first realized that I had some hearing problems. My wife used to say, Lyndon, you need to get your hearing checked, because I'd ask her to repeat things once in a while. Now she says, Lyndon, do you have your hearing aids in? But I did have a serious question beyond age disclosure and who may be hearing impaired. And that's with the remodeling. This is probably of Ms. Fraser. The remodeling of the state capitol, I thought there was some conversation, and I sat in on a lot of those planning meetings dealing with the redoing of the Capitol. Did we put loops in the Capitol and all the hearing rooms? What's the status there? Because you did mention the Senate office building, and so I was just curious where we are with the Capitol.
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser. There are hearing loops in the hearing rooms in the state Capitol as well as the state office building, and in one of the Attorney General's rooms and in one of the Governor's rooms as well. We also happen to have a loop installer here. If you have technical questions, they are available to answer them, although it sounds like your colleague knows quite a bit as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, you didn't happen to mention the House or Senate chambers. Are they retrofitted as well?
Ms. Fraser. Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, the decision was made not to install hearing loops on the House or Senate floor in the chambers, and I'm not quite sure why. But that does it. So there are still FM systems in the chamber, I believe.
That's kind of interesting, because some of us, and in fact, before I had hearing aids, we would wear the other device, and then we could turn the volume up and down. And I know I wasn't the only one doing that, so they would assume there were others that perhaps for one reason or another were having some difficulty hearing the debate. So it's interesting that that wasn't done. I didn't realize that. But I do feel this is an important issue, and not just because I wear hearing aids. I'll ask for some technical advice. When I find my hearing aids, and I will. They're somewhere in the house. When I find them, do I have to retrofit them some way to coordinate with the loops then, or is that something that happens automatically?
Depends.
Mine were fairly sophisticated hearing aids. I used to have a device, and I still have the device that, you know, I can, for listening to music, for listening to TV, conversation, you know, I think I got four different levels that I can adjust it for. So I don't know if I need to do anything else or not. I'm just getting some technical advice during the hearing, I guess, Mr. Chairman.
And who are you asking?
Ms. Fraser or whomever would be knowledgeable.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, my understanding is that you need to check with your audiologist to see if your hearing aid has a T-coil in it. If it does, you need to be sure that your audiologist activated the T-coil because it may be in there but may not be activated. And then have your audiologist show you how to change to the T-coil program, which then will connect with the hearing loop.
Well, thank you. I may have to check with the audiologist anyway if I can't find my hearing aid sometime soon. But
well, hopefully you don't have a cat.
No, we've got no pets, so that's okay. Well, it's just I've put them somewhere. But thank you.
There was a do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I was just going to, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to add to the information here. They have available here at the Capital System personal loops that you just put on. So there's a receiver that essentially, I believe, almost all of the sound systems, including most of the hearing aids, but definitely in the both floors, and the receiver receives the microphone's sound. So then the loop is driving your hearing aids, and she did share all of the information. Unfortunately, I know way too much about this, but yes, you do have to have hearing aids that have T-coils in. Almost all of them have the availability today, and you have to go through a cycle. I'm carrying five programs in my little computers that I have here, and I can flip through them. So that's how here we have accommodated it, is that you go to either the Sergeant Arms or I think Information Services, one of those two places, and they'll set you up and you can walk around and have T-coil personally.
Thank you, Reverend Stock. I got Reverend Bennett, Detmer, and Constantine on the list, and after that I would like to move to our final presenter, Reverend Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for probably one of the technical people, not sure who, because I'm very curious about these hearing loops and how it works, not necessarily the inner technology, but you know, physically when a hard-of-hearing person enters the room, how would they know that this is available for them? Is there an area that they have to sit? Do they have to be connected physically with this, or does it connect via Bluetooth or some frequency? And kind of how does that work?
Mr. Woodley.
Mr. Chair, members, generally there will be some notice. It's like if you go to the theater and you walk in the entryway, it'll say if there's hearing assistance. But for the most part, the staffing, when you come in with a committee agenda or something that you distribute, it could say on the give notice that loops are available for people wearing hearing aids. I mean, it's true enough that a person could walk in and not be aware that the system is there. But to accommodate people with hearing aids and let them know, I don't think is onerous.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, to add on to that, there are signs outside of the hearing rooms in the Senate buildings that notify people that there are hearing loops and that they can turn their program onto the telecoil. You do not need to be physically, once you are in the loop, my understanding is that and you turn the program on, you can, it, the sound just transmits to the, to your hearing aid. And so you don't need to be any particular place or plug in, and hearing loops are an alternative to Bluetooth.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a comment. This is an important subject regarding our men and women who serve in the military. I know the tinnitus issue. I have 25 years in the military, and now I have tinnitus. There's a constant ringing that you constantly hear. Any comments about tinnitus? Because this is a real issue for many of our men and women who are firing weapons on the range and so forth. They do have hearing loss along with the tinnitus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, my understanding is that hearing loss is the top injury of people who have served. And so, I understand that this is a big issue for people currently serving our country in the military as well as veterans. And two-thirds of people over 70 have a hearing loss to the extent that it impedes their ability to communicate. And so as the baby boomers age, this will become more and more of a problem. This is a low-cost way to keep people active. And Representative Ugham, I just wanted to mention that this bill was heard last biennium in the Senate, and I worked with Senator Newman on the language and made sure that the language, that he was comfortable with the language in terms of the requirements being able to be waived, and so that we lowered the standard. I was not excited about lowering the standard, but he was in the end happy with the standard about if the costs outweigh the benefits, then it can be waived. And so it's apparently, I'm not an attorney, but apparently a fairly low standard.
Thank you. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still not clear as exactly how this works. Would, for example, if I wanted to say something about Representative Lilly's haircut and I pulled the thing up so nobody could hear me, would the person in the loop still be able to hear me?
Ms. Woodley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, the first time I ever used a loop, I was in a meeting, just forget what it was, but it was a large group, and I made a remark to the person sitting next to me. I said, I can hear other conversations in the room. I could never do that before, and it was enlightening. So I would say, be careful what you say.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if that would impact our privacy then. And I'm, if we're discussing strategy or something serious that we don't want to have broadcasted, then even our whispering would be. And I'm getting close to that part. In fact, I told my doctor on my last physical I don't hear so good anymore. They disputed it for some reason. So how do you deal with that then? I mean, you would have a certain number of people that could eavesdrop on your conversations that were supposed to be private.
Representative Considine, I've got to be careful because we can already hear conversations in the House chamber that are supposed to be private.
Pulled up Representative Knobloch a week ago.
I heard it. Representative Pace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Considine. I think you're also forgetting that they can't hear what most of us hear. So I understand the whispering part of it, and I'm not so sure that that necessarily would be picked up if you have your mic up. But I think a lot of times when you're talking, or if you take your mic and go up, most of us can hear what you say anyway, just because we're in the room. It's not necessarily because of the mic. So data-wise, I don't know that it would make any difference. I really don't.
Yeah, I'm Steve Walsh, and I'm with Midwest Hearing Loops. I have hearing loss myself. And what it does is it kind of puts us back on a footing of someone with good hearing. So while with the loop turned on, if the microphone is active that you have, and you move it away and there's still some sound coming through it, I'm going to hear just like others that are in the room that have really good hearing are going to hear. I mean, it puts me back in the same place that others that have good hearing have. And in terms of dealing with privacy, we've done that in many cases where we're working in the courtrooms. I mean, and there's many times where we do need a mechanism to turn the system off so that we can have private conversations. So all of those factors can be dealt with. I mean, if you turn your microphone off, that's different than just moving it away.
Are you done?
It doesn't look like it satisfied your tip.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still not clear. Does the loop require the microphone to hear?
Yes, absolutely. If there's no microphone, there's no loop.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, that actually is very reassuring. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. Representative Tice, do you have any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. I just want to point out that this necessarily isn't just an older boomer issue. As Representative Detmer said, there's a lot of men and women who have served that have hearing issues, and there's quite a few members that have hearing aids because I check it out. It is something that I am aware of it since working with hard of hearing and with looping and such. It is something I check out. In fact, last week I met a young woman who is the Boys and Girls Club Minnesota Youth of the Year, 17 years old. She was wearing pink hearing aids, and I made a comment that, you know, that was pretty cool. I'll talk my husband into pink next time. Maybe I can see him better from behind. But, you know, hearing aids are not cheap. When Greg got his several years ago, it's $7,000 to start for hearing aids. And then if you get the doodads and stuff with them, it's a little bit more. So we're talking about an expensive device that folks use to hear what we hear normally. And anything I think we can do to make that even better is just a wonderful, wonderful deal. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. And House File 423 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, just comment, my brother is a Marine in Korea and wears hearing aids because of hearing loss from the guns in Korea. And I know that he gets his free of charge through the Veterans Administration. So, thank you. Next, we'll have an overview by the Department of Natural Resources on state trail rehabilitation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll get set up on a quick PowerPoint here. And thanks for the opportunity to address trail rehabilitation needs. I'm Kent Lacasmo, Director of Capital Investments for DNR. I'll give a brief overview, and then Deputy Director of Parks and Trails, Bill Leversedge, can fill in some more details. So trail rehab is only a small part of DNR's overall asset preservation and infrastructure unmet needs. I think some of you have probably seen our report. We identified $342 million of deferred maintenance. Some of that is on our trails. And as I think the committee knows, DNR has a different definition of asset preservation. It's natural resources asset preservation. It's in Minnesota Statutes 84.946, so it covers all types of our assets. It's not just buildings. So in DNR, we have 3,300 miles of roads. We have parks and wildlife and forestry. We've got 176 bridges on those roads. Trails, we have 614 miles of paved trails with 300 and some bridges on those and thousands of culverts. So most of the miles of our trails are on old railroad grades. So as we get these old railroad grades, we also came with those were 100-year-old bridges, trestles, culverts, and those we had failures. They're very expensive to maintain. We also do inspections of our bridges system-wide, and that's using the same standards that DOT or other governments use. It's the National Bridge Rating System, and we look at that We've got bridges that are, one that's critical, one serious, and eight poor. And out of those, out of our 10 worst bridges in the system, seven of those are on trails. And the cost to rehabilitate those 10 bridges, which in most cases is to replace them, would be $2.8 million. And that's just dealing with the crossings, and the resurfacing is also an additional cost. So the system continues to age. In recent years, it's been easier to get money for new projects instead of taking care of what we already own, and we need to make a concerted effort to do that. In our request to MMB last year, or for 2016 bonding bill, we had an initial request of $80 million for asset preservation, and about 25% of that was for roads and bridges, $10 million specifically for trails and trail bridges. And granted, that wasn't in the governor's budget, and there was less in the bill that was making its way through at the end of last session. But we would still have some dollars in there for trails and bridges. So real quickly, that's an overview, and I think we can get into some more details through the PowerPoint with Deputy Director.
Welcome. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Leversedge. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Parks and Trails, and here to help Kent give kind of an overview of our rehabilitation needs for our state trail system. So trails have become really popular all around the state, and they're a great way to connect Minnesotans with the outdoors and to promote healthy communities and strong local economies. So as you're all aware, there's been lots of interest in building new trails. We're here today to speak about the need to rehabilitate our trails as well. Minnesota has one of the largest state trail systems in the country. We've got 25 authorized state trails, and within that authorized state trail system, there are lots of segments of trails, so sometimes it's confusing because one trail may have five or six or more segments that become part of the discussion. But we have 25 named authorized state trails, making up about 2,900 miles. Of that, about just short of 1,500 miles are developed, and just over 600 miles are developed with pavement. So they're primarily bike trails. The system has grown by over 900 miles of authorized trails since the year 2000, and about 400 miles of new developed trails since the year 2000. So in order for us to help prioritize our investment, we developed a system plan, strategic plan, that categorizes our trails into three categories: destination trails, which are highest level of use and the area that we focus most heavily on. Then in the center, we have division-led trails, where we take primary responsibility for the trails. And then we have partner-led trails that are more community-led trails, where local communities are kind of the driving force behind the trails, and we provide the expertise and guidance, as well as take on some of the responsibility, especially as it leads to helping get the trails developed. But we count on the local communities more to drive this, building the support for those. And then we're also trying to develop stronger partnerships with the local communities to help take on some of the maintenance responsibilities on the partner-led trails. In addition to the destination trail, the system plan, safety is a primary consideration for us. So in the past, we've been asked to provide some information about how a trail goes from an idea up to the day of its operation, and you can see it becomes an idea and then gets legislative action. We have to do master planning and identify alignments, and then we're ready to start with acquisition and design of the trail. Oftentimes, one of the problems for us is we get big bunches of money right up front, and we're not ready to use that, so we get acquisition, design, and development money all at the same time. What we really need is a more planned distribution of the money across both, or all four categories: acquisition, design, development, and then rehabilitation. And it seems that rehabilitation is the area that struggles to get the funding the most. As Kent mentioned, one of our big factors in the cost of our rehabilitation is that we inherited the railroad system with all these old bridges, these 100-year-old bridges, and we've been working diligently to start upgrading them. The focus really became more of an attention after the I-35 collapse. I think there became an instant focus on what are the conditions of the state's bridge infrastructure, not just on roads but on trails. And what we're finding is that we had some trails that it was easy to develop in the initial stages because you could ride bikes across it, but now we're getting to the point where many of the bridges have structural deficiencies that are causing them to be unsafe for running maintenance equipment across, especially our snowmobile trail grooming fleet. The other factor in trail rehabilitation is just the age of pavement, and this graph just shows, based on a 25-year pavement life, where those critical points are. And on the far left is our current need. We have a backlog of trail maintenance or trail pavement needs, and then we have a little bit of a lag here for a few years, but then you'll see around 2025 we have a lot of trails that are going to come due for rehabilitation because there was a huge influx of trail development in the early 2000s. So if we average this across the years, we need to have a constant flow of about 30 miles of trail per year. Looking at that graph, we estimate that we have about 120 miles
that
we need to move.
What's the cost of that?
Pardon me?
30. You said 30.
So the cost per mile for just doing pavement is, Mr. Chair, is between $150,000 and $200,000 per mile. And that's doing some culvert repair and assuming that most of our bridges on those segments would be in good shape. Bridges themselves average about $300,000 to $350,000, depending on the bridge.
So you said $150,000 to $200,000?
Mr. Chair, $150,000 to $200,000 per mile to completely repave.
And in a typical year, how much do you spend to repave existing trails?
Mr. Chair, our need would be for about 30 miles per year, 25 to 30 miles per year. That would be $4.5 to $6 million per year of need.
And how much do you spend on that?
Mr. Chair, that's varied a lot. We have been investing some of our legacy, taking care of what we have, asset preservation money. And I think the number there is that we've been spending on the average of over 8 years, we've spent $23 million, so about $4 million a year out of asset preservation. But we're running into a backlog where our legacy dollars just can't take care of all of that.
So you're falling behind approximately $2 million a year, and the forecast is that that would be growing in the future.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So the next few pictures are just some examples of our trail conditions. So this is the Cicada trail down in the Mankato area, and it shows a segment that we did where we repaved 6.3 miles of trail, and it cost us $1.1 million. So the picture on the right is the repaved trail. Some of our trail rehabilitation needs are a result of catastrophic events, mostly weather-related events. This is on the River Trail. It's a relatively small repair, both in cost and in size, but it shows how dramatic weather events can be for us. This is about a $30,000 repair for a couple hundred feet of trail. On the other hand, the Munger State Trail in Duluth suffered a huge catastrophic failure in the 2012 flood. And just in 2017, we spent $2.6 million on rehabilitating culverts and trails on the Munger Trail. And that was funding that came through bonding as an emergency flood recovery.
And I would note on the Munger Trail culverts, they are very deep culverts. This railroad grade was very high. And culvert repair there can cost somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million.
And, Mr. Chair, I do have a picture of just one of those as we go through that will make it kind of amazing to look at what it takes to repair a culvert. Our our state proud bridges, as Mr. Loxmore mentions, we have over 300 state trail bridges. Some of them are in good to excellent condition, but we're concerned about the ones in the fair to poor and below categories. We have 22 bridges that are rated either fair or lower, and there's over $4 million need there. We have two that are in a condition where we can't run equipment across them at all. They've been load restricted to where it's nothing more than just small pedestrian and bicycle traffic. To give a couple examples of some of our state trail bridge repair projects, this is a bridge on the Root River Trail in Lanesboro where we spent about just over $500,000 to restore a National Historic Register bridge, about $160,000 for structural repairs and about $400,000 to resurface deck and the railing systems. This bridge is in Akeley on the Heartland State Trail. It was about $575,000 to replace the old railroad, or to take out the old railroad bridge and replace with a free span steel bridge. This is the example of the culvert on the Munger Trail, and it was a relatively small culvert. I mean, it wasn't a huge culvert, but it was 60 to 70 feet below grade. So in order to get down to it, we had to grade back almost a quarter mile to get down to the grades, and then also had to deal with acquisition because the railroad had expanded their railroad embankment beyond the ownership. So we had to deal with private landowners to be able to get permission to go ahead and replace that culvert. This culvert alone cost nearly $1 million. A couple examples of our projects that are on our current high priority list. The one on the left is the Great River Ridge State Trail near Plainview, Minnesota. We anticipate or estimate the project to be about $375,000. The one on the right is on Westminster Road in St. Paul. It's on the Gateway State Trail. It's part of a larger project to rehabilitate a segment of trail that, you know, the total project cost is $1.9 million. The bridge alone is about $300,000. And this bridge is pretty significant in that it gets hit by semi-tractor trailers a couple times a year because of low clearance. These two next examples are the two bridges that are in critical and serious condition where we are not able to carry loads on them. One is the Moose Horn River near Barnum on the Munger State Trail. You can see the abutments are failing on the left-hand side. It's about a $350,000 bridge project. The one on the right is Otter Creek Bridge near Carlton on the Munger Trail, and it's about a $350,000 repair. Just to give you an example, this is the Moose Horn River Bridge. Those abutments you may not notice as you're riding across the bridge, except this bridge is starting to tip because of the failing abutments. So in summary, as I said, the cost of paving, if it's just paving, is about $150,000 to $200,000 per mile. Bridges can add anywhere. Bridges or culverts can add anywhere from just a few thousand dollars to $1 million, depending on the difficulty of the bridge or size of the culverts, and can raise that cost of a mile of trail to anywhere from $250,000 to $1 million a mile to rehabilitate. This is a list of our current projects that are on the asset. We're on our asset preservation priority list. Most of these are projects that I've showed pictures of. It shows about a $9.3 million need in our current biennium. And with that, Mr. Chair, we'll try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Poston, I believe, is first to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you on, you said a trail repaving is $150,000 to $200,000 a mile. Before coming to the legislature, I was a city mayor, and we've been resurfacing roads, gravel roads specifically, and putting asphalt on top of them at a price less than that per mile. So I'm really surprised by that price. And I would think the roads probably require more asphalt than a trail does and so on. That just strikes me as being very expensive.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a high cost. It's an average cost. Some places it's less. But accessibility and access to this with equipment is oftentimes a factor. Roads are built and the equipment is built to do long segments of road. Here, oftentimes it's in and out on the same direction to do the paving, so that does contribute to the higher cost.
How wide is the path?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, our new standard for trail development is 12 foot.
Representative Polston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're looking at all these blacktop trails and things too. You manage gravel trails. What's the cost per mile to manage and replace a gravel trail? Do you have any clue in that?
Mr. Leverage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, Kent Sklar, our trail development manager behind me, just advised me that we've done some rehabilitation on limestone surface trails, for example, and the cost is nearly the same to do a major rehabilitation. We do find that our annual maintenance costs are lower on paved trails than they are on our gravel surface trails, because other than having to go in and do mowing and crack sealing, you don't have to do as much to maintain the riding surface.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Representative Uglum?
Then a little question about revenue and things. We all know, of course, that snowmobiles pay a permit fee to the use of the trails. Let's see, you got ATVs, bicycles, things like that. What are the fees now for snowmobiles, bicycles, and ATVs for trail use?
Mr. Leverage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, talking off my memory here, I think the snowmobile registration is currently $75 for a three-year registration, proposed to go up to $105 for 3 years. ATV registration is somewhere in the neighborhood, somewhat less, I believe, and I can get that information more accurately for you. And Mr. Chair, Representative Rubin, currently there is not a trail pass or trail fee for non-motorized use.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Uglum.
So there's no trail fee for bicycle use. Do you have any figures on how many bicycles versus snowmobiles and things use the trails?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, we do have some numbers based on the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota has done some recent work on trail counting on non-motorized trails. I don't have that off the top of my head, but can provide that for you.
Okay. I'd like that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I'd observe to follow up that question. I have a feeling the benefit to society of walking and biking is probably they have some lower health care costs that they're going to save us money in the long term. I couldn't resist that. In the presentation, in the pictures, it can give you a feeling of, oh my gosh, this is horrible. But actually, when you look at the numbers, of our 302 existing bridges, 280 of them are apparently in satisfactory good to excellent. And on the surface of the trails, 80% of them are satisfactory and excellent. So, I mean, you know, in the overall scheme of things, we're doing pretty well in terms of, they don't necessarily reflect on the pictures you showed us, but the bulk of our system is in really good shape.
Mr. Leverage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I think that is an accurate reflection. We have made some progress on our, especially on our bridge repairs, so our bridges are in good shape. We have that backlog and those that are in some need in the near future. And what we recognize on our trail surfaces is that even though majority of our trails are in good condition, they are aging out and they are going to need, you know, regular attention going forward.
And I think, Mr. Chair, for me, the inspiration of the people who work on these projects, the parks and trails, they come right out of the grassroots, right out of the communities who've done all the work before we ever hear about it. I mean, the commitment is on such a community level. And I know
you. I think you became aware of that in working with the city of Hutchinson.
Yes, I think so. As did you.
Thank you. Representative Gonsolin. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. I am really happy to see that the Cicada Trail between Madison Lake and Waterville is on your top priority. Last time my wife and I rode that trail on bicycles, she came back crying because of how many bumps and things that she had had. That trail gets a lot of use. It's a delightful trail, but it has gotten to be in terrible shape.
Ms. Glover?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I believe this segment that's on our current priority list may be the last segment of the Cicada Trail that needs to be rehabilitated. So we have been making progress on that over the past few years, but we do get a lot of complaints on that trail.
It's the worst section. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that section of trail. There are riders that prefer to go out and ride on the highway shoulder instead of the trail because of its condition. So it certainly is a safety issue that we need to address very quickly.
Okay. Thank you. Well, at this point, I think we'll bring it to a close today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stay tuned for any meeting announcements. You never know when it might happen. But as for now, as Sergeant Preston would say, well, King, this case is closed.